Yeah, I want to start to draw together the different strands, the different themes that we've been looking at over the course of 11 weeks, now 12 weeks. And clearly you can see that this model, this approach, there's got to be a plan, there's a curriculum. On the other hand, you're going with the energy of events as they unfold. You can't predict in January what is going to be at the center of the agenda necessarily in March. You may be able to make some educated guesses. And of course, the dimension of bringing in video conferences. I mean, it's just not as if there's 100 people just waiting to do this with us. I mean, each one of these events requires a lot of preparation, and you know, it's quite a spectacular thing. I think when I see in Ottawa, there's 30 people got together in a room in Ottawa to check out what's going on in a class in Lethbridge, you know, and these were obviously 30 interesting people. Last week, I didn't quite know who was going to show up. On the one hand, I was disappointed that we didn't have a high-profile person, you know, the head of the NDP, Brian Mason. But it turned out that Shannon Phillips was very, very incisive and had a real ability to give an overview of the issues, and it was almost information overload. There were so many elements to that topic. And yet, you know, seeing then the transition to this Saturday, where, you know, there was Shannon front and center playing a rich person complaining that she's not able to purchase enough, you know, high-quality health care, upper-end health care, that she's got to wait in line with the others, and how could you do this to rich people? I mean, it was quite a good marketing or advertising technique. But to see at that moment the news that Ralph Klein's political dynasty just collapsed in a moment, and there we were standing in Galt Gardens at that very moment, looking at now what? You know, okay, it looks like the third way is taking a breather for a moment. You know, when we talk about where's my pencil? Can somebody hand me a pen? Thanks. Here, if we go to the document camera. Look at that. I mean, that's pretty recently, $50 a barrel. We're long past that point. But this is a major, major concept. AON. This is where the media, this is exactly the kind of issue where the commercial media fail us, where you can see that there's an agenda, there's a plot. Who owns the newspapers? Can West Global? Who's on their board? What are their interests? So AON, this insurance company in the United States, setting up offices in Calgary and Alberta, taking over the quarterbacking, telling the government what they should do in terms of transforming healthcare into the very type of industry that they are the designers of, that they are the primary infrastructure of. It's mind-boggling. It was mind-boggling when I discovered a company called Burson Marsteller was doing the public relations for Anti-Kyoto, and that Ralph Klein was essentially, like Ronald Reagan, he was a speech reader, he was an actor, he can read the script effectively. And that tends to be the role. Ralph Klein was a reporter on CFCN, and he has an experience looking into the TV camera, the script, but somebody else writes the script. Peggy Noonan wrote the script for Ronald Reagan. So we're looking at a process on the planet since the demise of the Soviet Union in 1989, 1991. We're looking at something called neoliberal globalization. Neoliberal is a term that they use a lot in Latin America. I think it's quite an accurate way to describe it, because classic 19th century liberalism was about free trade, was about dismantling the British Empire, for instance, decentralizing power to the local legislatures, doing away with the Corn Acts. There was an element of it saying, don't regulate our use of children in the mills or whatever. We should have free trade. Now, liberalism is complex because liberalism also has to do with the movement to abolish slavery. Liberalism also has to do with the idea that men and women should be treated equally and that we should respect the equal dignity of every human being. I would make a lot of my political capital integrated into a defense of liberalism. I think liberalism can, in some senses, you know, we need some defense of liberalism. It's getting attacked from the right, attacked from the left. But there is this other part of liberalism, or this extension of liberalism, which, for instance, says, okay, corporations are persons. So corporations can hire, they can fire, they can sue, they can be sued, they can make contracts. Just like an individual, a corporation is like a person. And so classic liberalism says, treat every individual, every person equally. And so then it follows that, well, treat Shell Oil the same as John Veal. You're both individuals. You can go to court. You can sue Shell Oil, and Shell Oil can sue you. But in fact, you know, Shell Oil turns out to have a lot more resources, and they can pay for lawyers. They can take you to court for 100 years, and it's no problem. You'll go bankrupt in the first week. So this way that liberalism gets used and abused. So neoliberal globalization is how it's identified, but for instance, by the Zapatistas in Latin America, they'll talk about neoliberalism. It might be more simple to talk about capitalist globalization. I talk about imperial globalization. I want to use this to talk about, and I probably will before the night's over, to talk about ecological globalization, this rattle. It has creatures, it has beavers, eagles, whales, a human being. To me, this type of symbol, which obviously comes from the West Coast, is an image of an understanding that we are connected, that we are ecologically connected, that we seem to be single individuals, that us individuals seem to make up a single species, the human beings. But in fact, our species is connected to other species. You can't see roots growing out of my nose, but I'm sucking in air and drawing in nourishment, just like a tree sucks in nourishment from the soil. If the soil is polluted, the tree can't live. So ecological globalization, biodiversity, the fact that so many species are becoming extinct, that monocultures are everywhere rampant, that we are transforming, you know, the prairie grasses into corn monocultures. We are transforming old growth forests into spruce monocultures, just treating forests as agricultural, duplicating agricultural monocultures. So when you get a forest with all the same species, all the same age, it can't support a whole range of, you know, birds and insects, and you need rotten trees, you need old trees beside young trees. You can't have a range of birds without the different kinds of insects and funguses and snails and things that grow in rotting trees. So the impoverishment of biological diversity, the impoverishment of linguistic diversity, I mean, this is the other side of neoliberal globalization. If area is being used by species that have no commercial value, aren't part of the, you know, aren't used for hunting or food or fiber, or then it's sacrificed to the economy, to monocultures, to something that you can commodify. So the impoverishment of, could we say, biocultural diversity is a big part of this neoliberal globalization. So we've been talking about healthcare, but the universities would be next. If healthcare can be transformed into a business, why can't universities be transformed into a business? Unicorp. Recall that when we were connected with Ottawa, we connected with Mark Spooner. Mark Spooner made a very good presentation. And this issue of Canadian dimension, which comes out of Winnipeg, is focusing on the subversion of the university, the gradual transformation of universities into adjuncts of business. The effort is to increasingly integrate universities with commercial enterprise. And, you know, you have to appreciate that capitalism has to expand. There has to be 7% income every year on these pension plans. And there was a time, for instance, when the Western Hemisphere could be transformed into private property. The Western Hemisphere could be privatized. What is the worth of Lethbridge's real estate? What is the worth of West Lethbridge's real estate? What was the amount paid when treaties were made in 1877? I mean, you think when you put 25 cents in the parking meter, there was a point where that 25 cents might get you an acre in some kind of primal transaction with the indigenous peoples. So there's no longer a Western Hemisphere to privatize. You can continue to privatize the oil and gas resources, the uranium resources, but you know, you need to find new frontiers. So the new frontiers, for instance, are DNA. Under the auspices of intellectual property, privatize the architecture, the blueprints of life. And so you have corporations claiming to own different blueprints of life. And now you have the Human Genome Project. This is the next area of privatization. So this effort to privatize, bringing it to the universities, just a nice image, privatizing Canada's universities, and then this excellent edition goes on to give David Noble's views. He's at York University, private pretensions. So this is, there's one frontier after the next, and the capitalist system will go as far as it can, as it's allowed to go, in terms of privatizing any frontier. And we're going to talk about water tonight as a new frontier of privatization. But every kind of human relationship, every kind of thought process, you name it. If it's possible to create a commercial transaction out of any kind of relationship, that's what neoliberal globalization is going to do. And so it needs governments to give legitimacy to property, because property can't exist without sovereign authorities to legitimize that property and to create law enforcement mechanisms, for instance, if you steal somebody's property, there's got to be a law enforcement mechanism to decide and arbitrate and then readjust the theft if it takes place. But of course, theft is a very complex process. Was the Western Hemisphere stolen from the indigenous peoples? I mean, Eduardo Galeano in Open Veins of Latin America had a great deal to say about the process of theft. So was slavery a theft? Can the descendants of slaves say, well, all that work and all that property that my ancestors created, now somebody else has inherited that property, and my people are poor, and those people who inherited the property are rich. Should there be some kind of equalization? So these are complex issues. Now, this is I promised I would sort of go over some of the images that we looked at or developed over the course. If we can go here, remember this lecture Where is here, orienting ourselves to globalization, part two. And so these were different characterizations of where is here. Well, we're somewhere in the West. We're in somewhere called Canada. We're somewhere in somewhere called America. What is America? Is America a country? Is America a hemisphere? I mean, America is a work in process. Are Canadians Americans? We live, after all, in America. Are we Americans like Bolivians are Americans? I want to feel comfortable about saying, yeah, I'm an American. This is my hemisphere. This is the place I am, and I have a relationship with the United States of America. I grew up with it all my life. I understand it very well. I look like people in the United States, and I am an American, but there's something different about the political culture and different aspects of my culture. I would say we could look at Alberta and say Alberta has a history of being very connected closely to the United States. This is Wupup country. This is the territory that was supplied, the transportation system that brought this area into a global culture. That transportation system is the Missouri River system. And there was the Wupup Trail from Fort Benton to this area. Coal was exported along the Wupup Trail. That connection with the United States continues. I see occasionally, I'll see the Albertan flag with the U.S. flag flying over it. I think there's a lot of people in Alberta who feel much more comfortable with the government in Washington than they feel with the government in Ottawa. The government in Ottawa seems remote. There's a, you know, ironically, the national government of Ottawa in Ottawa is now from Alberta. And this image of alienated Albertans feeling remote from the national government, well, things have changed dramatically. So I want to focus on this neoliberal agenda, which is centered in the United States, which has an extension in Alberta. I want to focus on what's going on politically, where Ralph Klein has obviously had his most heady days of power. Jim Dinning seems to be the front runner. Jim Dinning, of course, came to power in the early days of the Klein regime. He was finance minister. He had been in New Zealand, where neoliberal globalization, neoliberal policies were, in a way, it was a laboratory. Try to diminish the size of public government, expand the corporate sphere. Jim Dinning was in charge of electricity restructuring. And electricity restructuring says, let's treat electricity like a commodity that you buy and sell in the marketplace. Let's treat electricity as a commodity where you can invest in or speculate in the future value of electricity, much as you speculate in pork bellies, or, you know, the future price of gold, or the future, and then the stock market is all about gambling on the future price. What where is it going to go in the future? And then you try to anticipate it with your investments. So the idea was to treat electricity in this same way. Now, electricity in Canada, in Ontario, it was a crown corporation. Adam Beck was in charge of a movement where more or less the new industries in southern Ontario said, we need to have cheap electricity. We should get together and collectively use the government to assure us cheap electricity. And so Niagara Falls was developed in that way. So Alberta broke out of the model, and now it's a very interesting part of our history, because it turns out that this experimentation in electricity deregulation, what was going on in Alberta under Jim Dinning's auspices as Minister of Finance, was preparing the way for deregulation in California. And it's the deregulation in California that led to the revelations that Enron was committing very, very aggressive types of accounting, types of bookkeeping. And of course, that now is subject to litigation. Ken Lay, who George W. Bush called Kenny Boy and was a good friend of his and a backer, a financial backer of his. Enron, the story of Enron is now a major part of business history. But how much discussion have we had in Alberta about the fact that Alberta was the test tube, the laboratory for this kind of energy deregulation? And I guess the question that could be asked, and I hope will be asked, and perhaps I might be in a position to press this question, which I'm going to put right now, Jim Dinning, where did the $4 billion go? Where did the $4 billion go? It seems that during this period of electricity deregulation, there's $4 billion that disappeared that can't quite be identified. Where did it go to? And I think at this moment, as we go into the next phase of Alberta's history, it's legitimate to ask the front runner in line to take over the top job in the province, where did the $4 billion go? Do we need a judicial inquiry, for instance? I mean, all of this type of information is carefully overseen, and the reporting of it is orchestrated by the 250-member Public Affairs Bureau, a kind of thought control police that the government the provincial government operate, to more or less keep control of the agenda. But suddenly, what is the agenda? We have politics from time to time. So this is the framework I would like to look at. Just a couple more images before I introduce Jonathan. I've come back again and again to this image. And this is the meeting of Ku Klux Klan in Edmonton, 1932. The Klan was active during the Crow's Nest Pass miner strike of that year, attacking both Communist Party involvement and non-English miners. So the history of the Ku Klux Klan isn't only about vigilante actions aimed at, for instance, black people who might be seen to have been a Moorist to a white woman, for instance. That in the South, that would be, just the suggestion of that would be enough to get an individual lynched. But there is another dimension of this far-right politics, that there is an obsession with those who seek to counter the privatization of, say, natural resources, say, coal in the Crow's Nest Pass, those who seek to use trade unionism, to use the organization of workers to take the position that those who invest their labor, their energy, their work in creating new economic value, that workers should have some decent level of compensation. If they get hurt on the job, they should be able to go to the doctor. I mean, these were principles that were fought for, and they were, you know, bitterly opposed by those on the far right. And I keep coming back to this image of the U.S. entrepreneurial class, the rich plutocrats of the United States, basically backed the right-wing regimes in the 1930s who were countering those who saw the division of wealth and the extreme privatization of wealth as the way ahead. And this issue of Time, and it's interesting that Time's founder, Henry Luca, was very supportive of fascism in Italy, and for a time infatuated with it in Germany as well, although by 1941 he changed, and he wrote a famous editorial urging the United States to rise to the challenge of the American century. And the project for the new American century which has most of the Bush cabinet in it. I mean, they took their reference from Henry Luca. But here in this report in Life, May 1995, here's an interesting image of patriots awake before it's too late. I love my country, but I fear my government. Images of skinheads. This language here, Hitler was the anti-politician, the uber-egoist who pursued his fantasies in contemptuous disregard for all evidence of the way the world works. As the German writer Sebastian Hafner put it, Hitler's subordinate history to autobiography. Well, that might be nice to think it was all about one crazy guy who just had some mesmerizing ability to make people lose all their consciousness and sensibility, and so we could just blame it all on this one individual who was the uber egoist of all time. But, you know, the reality is Germany was a pretty sophisticated place when Hitler rose to power, that lots of people found that position reflected how they saw it. He was taking a hard line against trade unions. And he felt that trade unionism was basically Jews. It was some kind of Jewish plot. And so there was a, you know, this whole ethnic dimension to it. But we shouldn't lose sight that this was a right-wing regime created to oppose communism, Bolshevik trade unions, the position of those who counter the view that wealth is there to be privatized and that broad disparities of wealth need not concern us, because if you make more wealth and you sort of liberate capitalism to drive to its fullest extent, you'll create more wealth, you'll create a bigger pie for everybody. Reagan said it would eventually trickle down to the poor. But we've seen that that hasn't been the pattern, that there is a growing disparity between rich and poor. And the privatization of healthcare, the privatization of universities, the privatization of supplying electricity, this is part of a pattern, a worldwide pattern, and we're in a position to comment on this and to move forward with an agenda based on the reality that there is a huge resource, that the future of Canada is tied up in this resource, and we are as in good a position as any people on the planet to have a say in how that might be structured and how we might deploy that wealth and come up with visions and images and plans and strategies, like, for instance, the idea of making this a learning society, a society where we use new technologies, where we innovate. I don't know, could you, Alyssa, show the iPod of last week's class? We just downloaded this, and I've been waiting to put the iPod on document camera. I did mention at the beginning of the term that thanks to Matt Sleto's good work, we're published on iTunes. This course is published on iTunes, and I get some satisfaction of that. Not to say that there's going to be hordes of people next week downloading from iTunes, but this is the way of the future. So, Alyssa, do you want to just take a couple of minutes to talk about iPods and whatnot?
All right. Okay, well, this is an iPod video. This is last week's lecture. Each lecture is split up into four sections so that it fits in your iPod. I don't know, you don't want me to say, Tony.
Okay, where's the...
Can we turn up the volume?
Sorry, what?
But how do you actually get... How do you choose what podcast is?
If you do a search for Anthony Hall on the iTunes Music Store, it'll show up and it'll give you a podcast.
I was just trying to turn the volume up.
This is a new platform, but anyway, this is obviously the way of the future, and
people are going to want to download their concerts, and they're going to want to download their sitcoms. Have any of you watched iPods? Say in the bus, you're going on a trip, or actually, it's not that bad because if it's you know, 1 foot from your eyes, it's still filling the same amount of space as say a TV screen 12 feet away. Will this be integrated into people's life? I suspect it will. And I suspect that, you know, there'll be an interest in downloading concerts and sitcoms and feature-length movies. But people are going to want also to get education of this. And there's going to be iPod downloads available in, Japanese butterfly design in Japan. Or, you name it. Self-help things. Are we
gonna sound the? Okay.
No, I don't think it's gonna work. Actually.
Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of interesting to see last week's class now downloaded from iTunes. So this came up by way of we're in an interesting place to innovate. Education, learning, teaching, this is a wonderful area to innovate. I would say that this is an area of provincial jurisdiction. And there's going to be a lot of tension over, who really is going to be in charge of, say, resource extraction. Is it really totally as within the provincial parameters of jurisdiction of constitutional powers as the provincial government has had us believe? Or is there a federal role for that? So let's put that aside and say one area where we can truly say without equivocation that we're in a provincial jurisdiction is in education, in higher education. And so I'm proud to introduce Jonathan Veal, who, to my way of thinking, represents a lot of what we can be proud of about our education system in southern Alberta and in Alberta. John is a lieutenant in the reserves. John is a quiet and soft-spoken but resolute activist for gay rights. John is a business student, and John has been working hard on studying the commodification of water. We've also made it part of his applied studied assignment that we look at the pedagogical aspect of these issues. We can get all the knowledge we can acquire, but if it just stays in our head, it doesn't have as powerful an impact as if we can articulate it and as if we can express what we've learned and the insights we've gained from what we've learned in an educated way and in an educative format. So with that introduction, Jonathan, you could go for a period of time and take a break, or I also have teaching evaluations that I've got to distribute at some point tonight, but why don't you take over from this point?
Just to get my stuff set up.
Why don't we carry on the discussion for 3 minutes?
Just be clear about the other day with Klein announcement that I listened to on CBC. The Klein didn't resign. He said that he would resign, and this question was asked by the media. Someone said, "This is not a resignation I have in my hand. What is this?" And he said, "This is a notice that he will resign if a leadership race has been called by the fall." So what he's saying, he's leaving all his options open for starters. He also said that it's business as usual in the meantime, which basically means that he's going to continue full force with privatization of healthcare, that's by no means on hold, and likely what he'll do is try and ram it through legislation, ram it through the House this spring, in the spring sitting,
there won't be a fall sitting if there's a leadership race happening, and we will be in the same position, except he'll jump ship. It'll be the rest of them that have to deal with the mess if it's unpopular and so on. So in terms of diligence and in terms of and the fact that Jim Dinning owns a health insurance company, which we've done some research on, and Shannon had done some phoning around as a purporting to be someone setting up a new business and looking for a plan for her employees, and they said that right now, you know, we've got this insurance. You'd have to go to the States to get the treatment, but soon we should have. And this was from Acure Health. This is from Dinning's health insurance company. That he's the chair of the parent company, but same thing. I mean, it's just a subsidiary. So whether the fact that Klein's on has announced that he'll be gone a year earlier doesn't actually change our reality at all. Like, I mean, it shakes things up a little bit, which is exciting. But I mean, Dinning will be. It's not like that's in some way on hold. I mean, likely he can just as easily just ram through the legislation and then walk and let everyone else clean up the mess.
But his 55% vote. Surely healthcare was an issue. Surely part of the unease with Ralph Klein expressed in that vote was partially an unease at him promoting the third way. Now, every candidate for the PC leadership job has got a political hot potato. This has been politicized. And so every candidate is going to have to come up with a very clear position.
Yep.
And
But in the meantime, he won't. He's still the leader. I mean,
he's a dead duck leader.
Yeah, but he's still, but he's duck? He's
duck.
He's still in a position.
Lame duck. That's better. Sorry, Ralph.
He's still in a position to railroad through this legislation. Like no one is going to ask Dinning how he feels about Dinning's not an MLA.
You know,
he's not there voting.
Like, no, Andy, when I look at Ralph Klein, I think probably there's he's probably a nice enough fellow, and you know, probably he's got some good good-hearted elements to him, and probably a lot of the things, if there was corruption in his regime, and I suspect it's going to come out that there was a lot. I mean, the question of where did the $4 billion go, Jim Dinning, that's one portfolio.
That's a great question.
There's other portfolios, and you know, it's possible that he wasn't always totally in charge and totally paying attention. And it's possible that we need now to sort of look beyond Ralph Klein. Like, for instance, what is AON going to do? Are we just going to go to the legislature, for instance, and hold up placards at the legislature? Maybe it'd be interesting to visit AON and point a media spotlight at AON. Who works for this? Who are these people? You know, why do they get to be so faceless? Who are the people behind Ralph Klein? Who are the people that wrote his speeches? What interests does he represent? Who are the big law offices in Calgary and Edmonton? And how is the oil and gas industry in this province really organized? Is it true that Calgary is more or less a colony now of Houston and Dallas? You know, how do we see that? Does the oil and gas industry, it must have Canadian investors? I mean, there must be different elements in competition within the oil and gas industry. So who is, you know, behind Ralph? Who has really been pulling the strings? Who has really been, you know, you've seen The Wizard of Oz and you know, get behind the show business of it and all the spin doctoring of it. Who has been orchestrating this, and this is the moment to really get into it, and I think this would be a service. It would be a service to the PC Party. It would be a service to all Albertans, and that's where we can use our credibility and also our skills and expertise as researchers, as investigators, as we've seen, for instance, James Moore doing in bringing out the contract. Hiring AON, where the contract is always saying, this is what's going to happen. We're not exploring,
We're basically saying, how are we going to do this? Not should we do this, but how are we going to do this? So we apprehended a crime. We did it.
But then where does that go? That's, I mean, I guess the questions are good to ask, and but if you don't have a media that's willing to distribute it, I mean, that will be one of the best things about things changing hands over time, is that the Public Affairs Bureau might become a little bit more exposed, and the 233 spin doctors that he has working for him. I mean, there's some of these things.
You know,
like, I agree.
The media have got to deal with this. Meanwhile, we're live on the World Wide Web.
Well, no, it's
recorded on iTunes.
But it's true. I mean, however many people download this class versus how many people see the cover of the Edmonton Journal. Where you're looking at early days, for sure. And I agree that it's all well and good to expand the view, and certainly diligence on Aon and Dinning are due. I mean, Dinning,
beautiful phrase.
Dinning is, he's very very vulnerable, really, because a lot of this stuff, he's got lots of bones in the closet already. But it is,
yeah,
I'm just saying that we can't
New Alberta.
I'm just saying that we can't rest on our laurels as far as healthcare goes, as if all bets are off and everyone's just cooled their jets. They haven't at all. I mean, Klein will still get it through before he jumps ship.
So for those not in Alberta, who's the Cor Blund Band?
Cor Blund Band is an excellent small town band originally from Tabor, and they were the Smalls for many years as a fantastic punk band, and. And the basis of the Smalls is Cor Blund, who has his own rockabilly act going on. It's done pretty well from here to Nashville.
Wonderful. Can we use that as a segue into the star of tonight's...
Yeah.